all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Bob Gould.
And good evening right there to all of you listeners right here at WAAM Talk Radio, 1600 Veterans Radio. Another program coming to you live and in person right from our studios at WAAM, right in the beautiful garden spot of the Midwest, Ann Arbor, Michigan. And with me, my partner, he's a little froggy. That's right. His voice got... I don't know how that happens in July, but... Probably allergy. It's Dale Throneberry, chopper pilot, the 195th Assault Group.
Thank you, Bob. Great to be here. It's another wonderful day in Ann Arbor. The pollen is flowing, the asthma is reacting, and the COPD is kicking in. So everything is working just fine. But I'm really excited to be here on to his program.
I'm glad you. I mean, this is right here. Here you were, a chopper pilot in combat, and you had a few medics?
We had a few medics on board. We were not a medevac helicopter, but we had a lot of wounded people on board, and we did meet some medics. And you know, as we're going to find out later on, how incredible these young men and women are and were at the time. And they're still highly revered by their comrades in arms, because these people always came to their rescue. It didn't make any difference what the circumstances was, people shooting at you, bombs going off and everything else. When the word medic went out, they came running.
You know, folks, when there really hasn't been, I mean, we all know what a medic is. In fact, even in civilian, call a medic, man. And it's become a buzzword. It's become part of our lexicon. That's a good one right there.
Yeah, there
that's
you
a
go.
University of Michigan.
That's
word.
A master's degree
lexicon.
Word. I like that one.
It's become part of our language, medic. But how many movies were made about medic? I can't. Well, there was in Platoon, they brought that out. They brought out a medic. He was one of the principal characters. And then, of course, we had MASH. But MASH was satirical. And quite frankly, I didn't think it was that accurate anyway. But medics, even though they have such a prominent, what's the first thing you're, when you're shot, you're going to mom and then medic. Always medic. And today we're going to find out all about medics.
This generation of medics.
Generational.
It is.
Yes. But
this is a whole new generation. I think we're going to find out that they're better trained than those used to be, and I think they're even more. They're not more dedicated, but they certainly know a little bit more about what they're doing. Because think about how many of these men and women that have been wounded that survived because of them getting to them first. That increase in I don't know what the word is I'm looking for availability of medical care so rapidly is saving so many of these men and women.
And that, well, we'll talk about
yeah,
that.
Ooh,
there's
will.
A lot of things that we're going to, and one of the earliest medics, one of the, was Clara Barton, and even Ernest Hemingway was in the medical corps. He drove
right,
an ambulance.
Right, in World War I.
He drove an ambulance.
Messed him up his whole life.
And yeah, he wrote
all about that. Yeah,
that's right. He wrote about that. So we've got it about medics. Even though there haven't been any movies, there haven't been any big time articles, we've got it right here on Talk Radio 1600 WAM. And right now, all the way from Germany, we have Master Sergeant Sean C. Hendricks. Sean, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Good evening. How are you doing?
Man, you are coming out clearer than the guys that are 3 feet away from me. That's amazing. What time is it right now in Germany?
It's 10. No, it's 11 o'clock.
It's 11 o'clock. Thank you very much for staying up late and being on our program. Sean Hendricks is a native of Long Island, New York. There we go. Dale kind of shakes his head. He's a New Jersey man. And he entered the Army in 1986. He went to combat training, advanced infantry training, medical specialist at Fort Sam Houston. He's got a wife and the proud parents of one daughter and one son. He was deployed to Mosul, Iraq, with the 172nd Striker Brigade Combat Team in August of 2005. Well, that's quite a... Man, you were there. You were there right there in the heat of things. Is that right, Sean?
That's correct. When we went to Mosul, it was kind of like the Wild Wild West, and it took a little while for us to kind of get it under control. But activity going on in Mosul when we got there.
We all know that medics are angels of mercy or devils of mercy, whatever you want to call. So we know all of that. But what I have been waiting to ask, and I do, we do have medics right here in the station. They're in the studio. They're going to be with us in just a moment. But we're all trained. We all start as riflemen. 11111 MOS. We're all trained as riflemen. And yet, and I wore the armband too, the Red Cross armband. I wore that. I had a .45 pistol. But were you armed, Sean?
Yes, I was. The Army's changed quite a bit from when I came in to when I deployed. From the time I came in, you know, I used that .45. That was my trained weapon until we switched over to the 9mm. And so when I deployed, I carried actually two weapons. I carried a 9mm and I carried an M4.
Did you have to pick up your weapon and defend yourself, defend your troops that you were in charge of? Did you have that opportunity that you had to do that? You had to become a rifleman. Tell us about that.
Okay, so not a lot of times do the medics end up shooting weapons. We carry them for defense, and with the way that we armed all of our soldiers going into Iraq, everyone was required to carry a long rifle. And so even though medics are in defense, we carried a long rifle. It was required. The only time I ever actually had to fire that rifle was in support of our Air Guard mission doing convoys. We would convoy from place to place to get medical supplies turned in and to check on our medics that are out in the company operating locations. And so during a mission going from the north to the south coming out of Mosul, we have a lot of placards on our vehicles, our armored vehicles, and we would always have air guards. And I was pulling air guard at this time, and we were told by the track commander or the truck commander that if people get up on the vehicle or if they come any closer than 10 feet of the vehicle while we're moving through the town, you need to at least do something to get them off. You point the weapon at them, and you yell at them, and if they don't follow your instruction, then you fire warning shots. And that's the only time I actually fired my weapon when I was deployed. All the other times, it was just kind of a show of force during that event.
I actually saw that on the American Heroes channel about 3 months ago. I couldn't believe that these civilians were surrounding the convoy, and it's like, politically, you folks were hamstrung. Here they were, and you didn't know who the bad guys were. They could have had whatever, and they were actually taking things off the vehicle. And I would imagine that you, being a medic, and did you wear the armband at that time?
No. none of the medics that were in my unit ever wore a brassard. That's what we called it, a Red Cross on a white background that was worn on your arm. We never wore brassards because they were basically targets. And when we moved around in theater, when we was in patrols, we rarely displayed big red crosses.
I would think
we rarely displayed that.
You would draw fire, right?
Exactly.
If you go to a wounded person, and then you are wounded, then all of a sudden, the platoon or battalion or company or what is in trouble. Is that right?
That's right. And here's the issue: is we was always protected by our unit elements, all the infantry soldiers, the field artillery soldiers, or cavalry soldiers, whoever we traveled with, they protected us as best they could, so that when they got injured, we would be able to respond. And so that was the biggest thing for us when we traveled with them, was they would protect us. They would put us in a position where if they drew fire, they would draw fire before we would. And that way, if they got injured, we could still respond and get them out of the area.
Now, medics were killed. Medics became casualties. Medics were wounded. Tell us about the Master Sergeant. That was your TLC mate.
So Master Sergeant Shaler, that was his name. Master Sergeant Shaler was an outstanding actual engineer. He was in the TOC, the Tactical Operations Center, with me. Let me go back real quick. I never actually, at the Master Sergeant rank, was in a company during my deployment playing the role of a medic, which is kind of the traditional way. I actually did a lot of the operations stuff at the brigade TOC level. So the Tactical Operations Center, my TOC mate, Master Sergeant Shaler, he and I had been together for about a year. When he got the opportunity to become a first sergeant in an engineer company, and we were all proud and happy for the guy. And after him serving with me in the TOC for about a year, he was all geared up and ready to go. And so he joined the 562nd Engineer Company as their first sergeant. But unfortunately, on his very first mission out of the wire, going on a mission to clear an actual pathway, to clear the road, his vehicle was hit with an IED, and he did not survive. And it was a tragic event for everybody in the TOC, because the guy was just well known. He was a great soldier. He was a great American. He believed that he was going to do great things out there with that company as their first sergeant. And unfortunately, the very first mission they went on, the vehicle was catastrophically destroyed, and no one in the vehicle actually survived that IED blast.
Now there you were in combat, and in some of the books I've read, movies, etc., and talking that I sometimes hear better for it to. I mean, I can't believe that you really mean this, but it's sort of a feeling that better in the beginning rather than you're almost done with your tour. So you want to touch on that a little bit? Did you, when you got toward the end of your tour, now you were extended. So first of all, what did you feel about being extended? And as you get closer to the end of your tour, did things get a little more hairy for you, for lack of a better word? Go ahead and tell us.
Okay, so unfortunately, the unit was not expecting to be extended for 4 months. We were in Mosul. And after our 12 months were coming to a close, we were all moving out. We were sending companies back. We had about 300 people back at Fort Wainwright, Alaska. And unfortunately, we got the word that we would be extended for about 4 months, and we were going to carry out the mission down in Baghdad. And so we moved from Mosul to Baghdad. We recalled almost all 300 soldiers that was already back at Wainwright. And the mission there was to go into Sadr City, Baghdad, and try to clean the place up and get some of the insurgency that was happening there, quieted and removed. And so you're talking, we had about, up until that point, we had somewhere about 35 fatalities in the unit leaving Mosul. And as soon as we got to Baghdad, within the first month, we had racked and stacked probably another 10 fatalities because of the war in Sadr City, the battle, rather, in Sadr City. That was the hardest time for our unit, because everyone was in the mindset that we had finished the tour and we were ready, we were safe, we were going home. We had people back in Fort Wainwright living with their families, for a few days, and they were just ecstatic that they had made it. And the tragedy of it was that when we pulled those 300 soldiers back, obviously some of them did not make it. They didn't make it home after the tour because they were in that battle of Sadr City, and a few of them that were called back from Wainwright were casualties. I was blessed in the sense that we didn't lose but one medic in the entire 16-month tour. The only medic that we lost was a young PFC, and he was out doing just that when they were clearing buildings. They were kicking in doors. They took a lot of fire. He moved to help pull a soldier back. It tripped the wire and half the building blew and took everybody that was in the building and that medic out. And so that was the only medic that we lost during that time frame.
How did you and your other fellow troops, I know it was an American mission to win the hearts and minds of the civilian population. How did you folks feel about that, and how did you go about doing that? Tell us.
The best thing that I can recall about our mission to win their hearts and minds was we went on medical, what we called I'm losing the term, but it's a medical mission where we went into the towns and we tried to provide local medical care for the people that obviously lived there that needed, you know, they needed some type of antibiotic, they needed something for maybe, you know, the vaccinations that we could provide. We went out into the towns on a regular basis right there in Mosul, the areas around Mosul, the areas around Baghdad. We went on these medical missions somewhere around at least once a month to provide them with some type of vaccination or medical exams, things like, you know, dental work. We did a lot in those towns just to show that we were there and we cared about them and we wanted to make life better for them. And so whatever we could provide at that time so that we could, you know, obviously win their hearts and minds and make them feel like we're here to help you build your country and not suffer from the oppression that you're suffering from.
Amen to that. Describe your feelings when you left.
I had a little bit of a mixed feeling when I left Iraq, mainly because I was there for so long. I had kind of grown, you know, close to all the people that I worked with and worked around, my comrades, and I knew that when I got back, I would be leaving Alaska, and I'd probably be leaving most of the people in that unit. The Army is just built so that when your tour is up, they send you somewhere else, and it's not always going to be with the same group. And so I had mixed feelings about leaving Iraq because I knew within a few months after that I'd be leaving that unit. And I had built a lot of friends in that unit and a lot of trust in the people that I work with.
Well, you have experienced what a small percentage of our population have experienced, and that is combat. And today, How often do your thoughts take you back to that time?
I'm always listening to what's happening in Afghanistan and hoping and praying that it will come to a close the way Iraq did. And so I'm constantly, you know, recalling those events and the time that I was there because it was a long period of time for me. 16 months straight was a rough amount of time. So I think about it quite a bit. I remember my job as a medic in the brigade surgeon section, which is where I worked in the TOC, was patient tracking. And so we were responsible for tracking everywhere that a patient was injured and everywhere the patient went back to be recovered. And so a lot of those thoughts keep coming in my mind as I as I reflect on it and how many injuries there were versus how many fatalities there were. I'll never forget those things.
Boy, I'm gonna leave right on that thought. I think that says it all right there. Sergeant Sean Hendry, that's a master sergeant, folks, at three up and three down. And how long have you been in the 86? I'm trying to, what is that, 28 years so far?
I'm coming up on 28, that's true. December will be 28.
Are you going to retire? No, I know you're a lifetime soldier. You really represent what we strive to have as far as the character and the perseverance and the training of what we call our America's finest. And you certainly are a prime example. And I want to give a Veterans Radio salute to you, Master Sergeant Sean C. Hendricks. And thank you very much for being on our program. If you'd like, we're going to have to get you off the phone, but you can go and, by the way, folks, you can go to veteransradio.net, be sure it's .net, and listen to the rest of the program. Okay, Sean?
I will do that. Thank you. And I appreciate you having me. You have a blessed life.
And you too. Wow.
I was just thinking what he was saying there at the end as you're getting ready to go home, and you
get extended.
Well, the getting extended thing, and the getting extended during our generation was you could extend for 6 months in Vietnam, and it seemed like the fatalities and injuries percentage went up when those people stayed that little extra time.
Why do you think that was?
Well, for one reason, they could get out sooner. And no offense to career military, but there were many of us that wanted to get out as soon as we possibly could. And so if you extended for 6 months, you were done. And otherwise, you came back like I did. I was back in the States for another 2.5 years as an instructor. But two guys that I knew that extended got killed within 3 months of going back for that extension. But the other thing that he talked about with that camaraderie of your friends, and you're going to lose touch with them. In today's world, you're not going to lose probably as much as you would have, but just the idea of somebody going to Alaska and somebody going to New York and somebody going to Florida is you're just not going to see them every day, and they were such an important part of your life for that time period.
The bonding.
Yeah. These guys are both shaking their
heads.
I know. So I'm going to turn it over to your
guests. We got a break
you
coming
take
up.
A break? Okay.
We have, let me get my notes over here, the Canton Foundation. That's right. They're having the fifth annual Veterans Summit. Folks, you're going to want to pay attention to this. Derek, hit it. Our veterans put everything on the line to protect our freedom. And while we can never fully repay them, we can make sure that they're armed with the right information to succeed. Michigan veterans of all ages are invited to attend the Canton Community Foundation's 5th Annual Veterans Summit Wednesday, September 10th at Laurel Manor in Livonia. There they'll find out about the VA benefits to which they may be entitled, as well as having veteran service officers available to meet with them one-on-one. For more information or to register for this free event, go to cantonfoundation.org. And once again, for more information on this free event, go to cantonfoundation.org. Thank you for your service. Okay, we're back on Veterans Radio. And by the way, that is the Canton Community Foundation 5th Annual Veterans. What do you do at a Veterans Summit? I don't know what my benefits are, and that's why I don't go to the VA. Well, you know what? You go to things like this summit, and that's where all that information is. Don't read the book. I mean, have you ever picked up, all you vets, you picked up a manual? They got all the whereas and the therefores and the, oh, man, forget that. You got a chance to go one-on-one. And by the way, all you folks out there that are listening throughout the world, and you have an event you want to give us, that's Dale or Bob. That's Dale at veteransradio.net, and that's Bob at veteransradio.net. It can't be any easier than that. Well, what else is easy is to be able to go to these things like that summit. We're going to be talking about that every single week leading up to that. Good. Okay, back to medics. And with me are two handsome gentlemen. There they are. And John, I got to get you to get a little closer to the mic. That's it. A little even there. Yeah, you got to get right on up there. We have John Primo, and of course you remember Andrew Turner. He's been on our program many times. Both of these boys are medics. Both of these boys have had tours in the Middle East. John Primo, tell us about your when did you go and how many tours did you serve?
I served at we were sent with the 1st of the 182nd Field Artillery in support of OIF-3. So we were deployed for that mission in September of 2004 and returned home December 2005.
Andrew?
Yeah, I was on the same mission with John here. He and I were roommates, actually. deployed with our National Guard unit, and I guess here we are in the studio with you guys to share our stories.
I do. Oh, and I do have somebody on the phone. That's, we can't forget Rachel. We have Rachel Shalakis. Rachel Shalakis, who is a female medic. Oh, boy, we're going to talk about that. Rachel, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you.
Oh, good. Now, we got everybody connected. We've got Germany. We got Lansing. We got Rachel. We got Andrew. And we have John. Rachel, very quickly, we've got about a minute and a half before the break. Don't go away, Rachel. But when you were a medic, a female medic, is that correct?
That's correct.
And, all right, you're serving a bunch of guys. And was it, hey, what's going on? Or was it, boy, we can't wait, they put you in the field? Did they test your mettle? Tell us about that.
You know, it only takes about 2 weeks of kind of sizing you up to see how you operate. And after 2 weeks, you're one of the guys. There's no difference.
One of the guys. Okay. And there you go. And did you replace somebody?
I did. On one of my deployments, I replaced someone. On a second deployment, I fell in with the same unit.
Okay. And we're kind of losing you, Rachel, so you have to stay real close to the phone, wherever you're at. If you turn your head, we can't pick you up, but that's all right. I'm sure communications there. Oh, we've got 30 seconds, right? All right. So, Rachel, we'll be back to you in just a few moments, so don't go away. Dale?
Yes.
we're
a limited number of microphones in here. So you got about 30 seconds. We're going to be listening, coming back and talking with medics, more medics and their stories about what occurred when they were in Iraq.
Oh, I know. I can't.
I'm excited. I've talked to other female medics, and they've done really well.
This is the Blaze Radio News. I'm Dave Perkins.
Hamas has broken 5 ceasefires that we accepted and we actually implemented. They rejected all of them, violated all of them, including 2 humanitarian ceasefires in the last 24 hours.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu explaining why Operation Protective Edge continues in Gaza.
Now they come with their own ceasefire proposal, and believe it or not, they violated even their own ceasefire proposal. They're shooting at us as we speak.
The search for weapons and explosives and hiding places for them continuing in Gaza now. The IDF posting video showing Hamas firing rockets at a crowded Israeli neighborhood, a school, even a cemetery. The IDF searching homes of suspected Hamas operatives in Gaza after finding a cache of explosives hidden next to the crib of a baby. You can see that video online now at theblaze.com. Pro-Russian separatist fighters defending the airliner crash site in Ukraine against the armed forces of that country. Ukrainian military trying to get control of the site so their police can take over the investigation. Security concerns now being cited as police cancel that planned visit.
In Lakeland, Florida, a man's grief after his 48-year-old wife dies from an aneurysm turns to shock when he finds his home's been broken into. Missing are his TV and a laptop that belonged to his late wife, containing a number of photographs and messages from their 28 years of marriage. So Jerry Ashley decided to make an appeal to the gutless cowards that broke into his house by spray painting a message on his garage door, saying he doesn't care about the TV, but that he does want the laptop back. Ashley's note promising a $150 reward for the laptop's return, no questions asked.
The Blaze Radio's Greg Moore, and in Northern California, 10 homes destroyed, hundreds evacuated as wildfires continue near Yosemite National Park and in the Sierra Nevada foothills. I'm Dave Perkins. This is news on the Blaze Radio Network. Truth.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Applebee's Restaurants is a proud sponsor of Veterans Radio. For the best in family dining, you'll want to make any Applebee's restaurant your destination for just plain good food, service, and complimentary military discounts. I'll bet you didn't know that on Mondays it's called Military Mondays at Applebee's. It's 30%. Man, you can have a good time. 30%. Woo-wee. Where are you going to find that anywhere and get the good food and the service and all that that goes with you? At Applebee's, that's Applebee's Restaurant. They help Veterans Radio deliver our program to you. Yeah, we're back on Veterans Radio. I do want to thank our other supporters. You got Legal Help for Veterans, Schoolcraft College, Applebee's Restaurant, and, of course, Len Pitlack, CPA. Wow, back, Dale, you had a few other things.
Well, it's interesting that you were talking about Applebee's, so I want to make sure that people are aware that you need to, if you're not in the southeastern Michigan area, you need to check with your local Applebee's to see if they do have a military discount, because we had somebody gave me a call from South Carolina, and he didn't get his discount, so he was concerned about
that.
So I said, you talk to that manager and, you know, let him talk to us, and we'll see what we can get through there. That should be a nationwide thing. But anyway, check with your with their manager at your local Applebee's and make sure that you get the discount that you're entitled to. The other thing I wanted to point out was that you can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and on Twitter, and one of our sponsors is interested in finding out how many followers we have on Veterans Radio's Facebook page. So go in there and sign up so we can go back and say, we've got thousands. You should contribute more to supporting the radio program, right?
And I also want to thank the Rally Point folks, the Rally Point folks out of Boston. All of you veterans out there, it's putting together a network of veterans. They're doing all sorts of great stuff. You don't need me to say this. You got to go to Rally Point. It's just plain rallypoint.com. Google it and dot-com it and do all that and get all that information and check out Rally Point. We've all joined here at Veterans Radio. They have over 300 members. That is how we were able to find Sergeant Hendricks.
300,000.
300,000. What did I say? 300. Oh, gosh, yes. There we are. Oh,
this
Lord.
Is why we're here.
I know.
300, it's a LinkedIn website
it's
for veterans.
It's a LinkedIn.
And it's got employers, guys looking for jobs. It'll connect you with other military members. It's a great spot for all you men and women out there to contact each other.
And the big guy, the CEO, was Recon Sniper. I mean, 10 years, folks. So we don't have any wuss here. Not at all. Not on Veterans Radio. Okay, back to being medics. And now I got John and Andrew and Rachel on the phone. Rachel, when you said it only took a couple of weeks, and how soon was it before you left the wire?
It depends on the mission that I was on. The first deployment to Iraq in 08-09, I didn't actually leave the wire for about 6 weeks. My second deployment to Afghanistan in 2012, I left within a couple of days.
And, of course, you had, which would be an unfortunate situation. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yes, actually, in 2012, during my deployment to Afghanistan, about 2 months in, I was injured in an IED blast. And very quickly sent home.
You know, folks, we hear all the time about, we really do put our well-trained, and these are not draftees, folks, these are well-trained soldiers, airmen, Navy personnel, that we put them in harm's way. And here is somebody who is been trained and is and was put in this situation and was injured. Did you ever get a chance to go back, or were you sent home?
No, I was sent home after about 24 hours. They held me in theater just to do some surgery and then bring me back home.
And are you in civilian life now?
Actually, I still serve in the National Guard.
And if you were to say something to the women out there, the females out there, what would you say to them about, you know, and back in my generation, if you got nothing better to do, you join the Army. Well, that's not that way anymore. And if you had something to say, and I meet females, women, we talk about young folks, and we talk about making a career, what would you say about that?
The military isn't for everybody, and it's not for every female, but if you have a drive to do something with your life, to have a service to give to your community, to your country, to really feel a connection with the people that you work with, this is a wonderful career opportunity. I will never regret a day I have spent in the military.
John, Andrew, comment. Which one? Yeah, they both pointed. And by the way, folks, in fact, why don't we start with this? As far as John and Andrew, were you in basic training when you got the word that you were going to be deployed? Were you at basic or were you advanced infantry or where were you?
We found out that we were going to be deployed for, we found out that we were going to be deployed at our annual AT. We knew that this mission was coming down the pipe. But we didn't know who was going to go. Our battalion at the time was about 300 members, and we knew that they were going to send 150 of us.
So you were standing out, and they're calling out names.
And they're getting closer and closer to P, and all of a sudden I hear Specialist Primo, Jonathan, and I knew that for the next year and a half or so that my life was going to be changed.
It's a big time. Did your heart skip a beat?
Oh, it did indeed. It did indeed. And then at that moment, Turner and I, Andrew, we're medics, and there's a little part of me that was like, oh, don't call Turner. And then there's another part of me that was like, please call Turner, please call Turner. Yeah, exactly. And we ended up being there together.
Yeah, so it worked out pretty good for John that I got to go along with him.
That happens to be Andrew right here, folks. Yeah. Yes.
My wife sent him a thank you card for helping me get out of that deployment. But no, I mean, I knew that there was no way I was getting out of it. We were short on medics, and no matter how much I sat there thinking, you know, don't call my name. I knew that there was no chance that I wasn't going. And John and I were roommates for the entire year over there. We, did everything that was asked of us. We were out on mission constantly, you know, keeping an eye on our guys and making sure that they could do their mission to the best of their ability and feel secure that, you know, we were there to protect them if they needed it, and they were there to protect us.
Did either one of you had to pick up weapons, arms, to defend yourself?
We didn't get the same kind of weapons like the mess sergeant talked about earlier. We only carried our sidearms, our 9mm. But my platoon sergeant for the platoon I was attached to fortunately understood that when I joined to be a medic and I went to my medic training at Fort Sam Houston, they called us soldier medics with emphasis on soldier being first. So he made sure that I was trained in all the weapons that our platoon had so that if somebody went down, I was prepared to pick up a weapon and use it. Not that it was my responsibility or my job to do that, but if the need was ever there, I was able to use those weapons.
And that was across the board, the same with my platoon. Whenever we had an excellent opportunity to train the Iraqi police, and as a part of that, we frequently had them at the range, and a part of my responsibility, on top of making sure that everyone at the range was doing things safely and correctly, was to be trained up on those weapon systems in the same scenario, that if anything happened and I needed to pick up a weapon, I could. That being said, though, my primary mission is to take care of my troops. So if somebody did go down, I would take care of that individual before hopping out.
I'm going to ask all three of you, and please say your name first so we know who's who coming. Of course, we know who Rachel is, right? I'm sure we can tell that. But did either one of you replace somebody who was wounded or killed?
No.
Rachel?
No, I never did.
So the medics that you replaced had mustered out, essentially. Okay, so did you find that in the beginning, the guys and the gals, the troops, did they welcome you, accept you, or were they waiting to see, okay, let's see what this person's made of?
I think this is John. This is one of the beautiful things about the National Guard is that I'd been drilling with these individuals for about 5 years before I was deployed. So every one of the people that we deployed with knew full well our capabilities from having been out with us in the field. So we were really welcomed with open arms when we deployed.
Yeah, and that, you know, you're treated differently too. As a medic, I was a specialist. I was an E4, lower enlisted, but I was respected so much more above my rank because of the skill set that I brought to the platoon. I was the only medic with that platoon, and I was responsible for, you know, responding if any of those 45 guys went down. So, you know, a level of respect comes with it, and you're not called Specialist Turner. I wasn't Specialist Turner like I would address somebody else as Specialist or by their rank. I was just Doc, and everybody
was
called you Doc.
Rachel, were you called Doc? Doc?
Oh, always.
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 And it is a term of endearment, right?
It is. It takes usually a little while for the guys to get to know you. It comes with respect.
And the respect, of course, is earned because you're well-trained, all of you going to Fort Sam Houston. I happen to be a medic with the 326 Medical Battalion, 101st Airborne. That was in the Battle of the Bulge, the 326 Medical Company, I think it was back then.
I think you were there.
we got a jokester here. No, I was not there. No, I was actually alive. I was alive at that point. But I remembered the pride that I felt to Man, when I put that armband on, boy, that was a whole different thing. I felt that I could really make a difference. John, Andrew?
Yeah, like the Master Sergeant was saying earlier, we didn't wear our armbands because that was just a big target. So I have a couple of pretty nice, fancy, unused armbands in my closet upstairs in my little, you know, Army display closet that have never been worn. But
when I was pre-interviewing you folks, I asked for some talking points and things, and John responded back, the inability to get revenge. John, comment on that.
That's a so there you are, for lack of a better phrase, out in the field, and something happens to one of your fellow soldiers. And what really makes it difficult is that most of what we see are IEDs or sniper attacks, and you can't just go crazy and start tearing into the entire area. You know, there's specific targets that cause these events to happen, and a lot of times there's no one to go after. So one of my friends is killed, and I'm trying to take care of him, but who can I kind of get back to? No one. You know what I mean? And there's kind of a hollow feeling there.
You had to mentally eat it.
You do, indeed.
And what did you do to relieve that? You drank beer.
No. You know, from that point on, after that happened, you have to separate yourself from, you know, that you're a medic. And you need to do your job regardless of who the person is, be it Iraqi, be it the soldier that's there, be it the guy that may have shot your friend. And you really have to detach and treat people with the respect that you would want to receive from them, regardless of what has happened in the past.
Andrew?
Yeah, I guess that's probably why I didn't make more of a longer career out of being a medic. There's just only so much I could take of having to, you know, kind of turn the other cheek, because it's not a myth when they say that you are trained to treat the worst injury. And if the worst injury is the enemy, you're going to have to treat that enemy. It's your responsibility as a medic, and it's your duty to treat that individual.
I know. I saw.
It's very difficult.
I saw that in a MASH episode where they had the American and the North Korean, and they actually shot each other. And there they were at table side by side, and the dichotomy of that. John, you had your, and I like this, the yin and the yang, folks, that first it was kill, 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 and then save, save, save. Tell us about that, John.
It's an interesting headspace. You go to basic training and you come out, as you spoke earlier, a rifleman, and you feel 10 feet tall and bulletproof, and you want to take it to the enemy, you know, and then you get to medic school, and all of a sudden you're not, I mean, you are trained to be a rifleman, but you have this extra mission ahead of you, not to bring the heat as much as it is to take care of your individual soldiers. And it puts you in this strange headspace, trying to balance the rifleman side with the medic.
Rachel, you want to comment on that?
Actually, I would like to. My first deployment, I spent some time working at a detention facility, and my mission there was to actually care for the local detainees, the Iraqis who were brought in by our local troops. And that is a very difficult thing, to separate yourself from these individuals who you know have been picked up.
How did you do that? What did you say to yourself?
It's not my job to be judge nor jury. That's not for me to decide. My only mission as a medic is to ensure that the people in front of me are taken care of.
And did you carry that back with you when you came back to reality, when you came back to the real world, and have your thoughts gone back to that?
They have, actually. You know, you meet people and you get to know them as people, and you realize that we all have our own ideology, we all have our own beliefs, and I have to respect yours as I would like you to respect mine. I may not agree with your beliefs, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you have done some sort of crime against me or mine. If you've not been convicted, it's not my place to judge.
Well, we're going to hold right on that thought. We'll be right back. This year, listening to Veterans Radio right here on WHAM, WAAM, Talk Radio 1600. We'll be right back with our medics.
I've got your six.
I've got your six.
I've got your six.
In the military, got your six means I've got your back.
I've got your six.
Through jobs, education, housing, and more, we can support returning military veterans and their families. Please show your support and prove to a veteran you've got their six.
I've got your six.
I've got your six.
Go to gotyoursix.org for more information and to purchase six merchandise like the now famous six lapel pin that you can buy and wear to show your support.
Wow, we're back on Veterans Radio right here on Wham Radio, Talk Radio 1600. Dale?
Yes?
Yeah, tell us about, give us some of your thoughts on the things that we just talked about. I mean, you know, especially about when you got through with the mission and you had to do something. Even when I come back from this program, you just don't, you know, have dinner, you're kind of like, wow, I just did this. What
well,
did you do?
Well, you have to kind of breathe for one thing and decompress. And I was interested in what Rachel was saying about you have to treat the patient, and you don't know who the patient is, what the story is behind the patient, because many times when we would pick up wounded people in Vietnam, we would pick up bad guys and drop them off at the hospital.
Drop them off from
like,
500 feet?
No. But you know, and we couldn't, we didn't have the chance to determine whether they were good guys or bad guys at the time. I mean, we knew they were bad guys, but we weren't going to do anything, even though sometimes you're tempted, because whatever it is, your basic instincts kick in, and you want that revenge that he was talking about earlier, but you just can't do that, because then you're lowering yourselves down to an animal, and, you know, we've talked about this on our program many times before. There are morals and ethics involved with war, and it's hard to believe that there are rules, but you want to play it at the highest level you can, and if you fall down into that sewer with the rest of the people, then it's just chaos, and you're not going to accomplish anything.
They call it, folks, the rules of engagement. The rules,
right?
The rules of engagement, and they change. They change as everything else changes.
With every war, they change.
Okay, we've got clinical detachment. John, why don't you tell us about that?
All right. So again, this is John. And clinical detachment, it's really, really important, because regardless of whether you're treating an Iraqi or even our soldiers, you need to make sure that you can pull yourself out of that headspace. If we're National Guardsmen, you know, we serve with our brethren for extended periods of time, and we know each other really well. And if my best friend is laying on the ground, I have to be able to take care of that gentleman. So I have to be able to pull myself out of that headspace and see him as a patient instead of as my friend. Same thing with the enemy. When we have people that are firing in at us, as Andrew alluded to a little while ago, regardless of who has the worst treatment, you treat that person. So, again, it's pulling out of the headspace of who this individual is and focusing in instead on what the wounds are and how you're going to take care of them.
Rachel?
It is very difficult. That's probably the most difficult thing that I had to do, was separate myself from my concern for my friends and my family. But as you've heard it stated twice already, it really is the most important thing that you can do for the people you care about.
Andrew?
Yes, like I said earlier, that's part of the reason I didn't make my medic career longer, because I, you know, to a certain extent, I just wasn't comfortable doing that anymore. I just, you know, I needed to view the enemy as an enemy, not somebody that I need to treat, you know, above and beyond my soldiers. And that's kind of why I moved on to a different career path in the military.
You know, and I find myself, I was not in combat, but I find myself being that judgmental. I think that would have been a very, very, very hard thing for me. And it had to watch that, to see your friends and to see the indiscriminate attitude of killing that the other guys, the bad guys, seem to have, and toward the civilian population, and all that would have to come welling up. I really have the absolute most respect for you folks. Andrew and John, you worked with civilians. What did you, John? You first. What did you do with the civilians?
We really had two branches of work that we did with the civilians. First and foremost, our mission was to train the Iraqi police. And as a part of that mission, we were in their stations every day and seeing their detainees. So a large portion of what we did was going into these detainee cells and doing health and welfare, making sure that the detainees had what they needed to stay healthy, making sure that things were clean, and then treating problems that the detainees had. So
you didn't put any underwear on anybody's head or any of that other stuff, right?
Well, I mean, what happens in Iraq stays in Iraq.
But,
that wasn't something I was into.
I was only making a comment on that because, we won't go to that. But you did look at their conditions.
Oh, very much so. And something that's kind of interesting about an Iraqi detainee cell is that there aren't just criminals in there. Sometimes people are placed there to keep them safe. So we were looking at the well-being of not only the criminals that were thrown in there, but the civilian population that was being taken care of as well.
Andrew?
Well, and even on top of that, with a lot of the corruption there, you would have people that were being detained simply because the police were trying to extort money from their family. So we didn't necessarily know who we were dealing with. We didn't know if we were dealing with, you know, a hardened criminal that deserved to be in there. We didn't know if we were dealing with somebody who, for a misunderstanding or unfortunate set of circumstances, found themselves in there. And, you know, we were really the only type of medical care that they had. So we tried to do the best that we had without downgrading our supplies too much and still be able to do our jobs and try to give them the help that we could give them.
Did you find that the bad guys were telling the civilian population things like the Americans are poisoning you, the Americans are bad, don't go with the Americans? Go ahead, John.
This is John. We kind of had the opposite of that in that very small wounds, very easy to take care of problems, would get us intel. So a guy comes in with a boo-boo, and you put a Band-Aid on it, and now he starts telling the interpreter where the bomb makers are at. So that little bit of, you know, love and care for these people really helped to better the situation for everybody.
Rachel, you want to comment on that?
You know what? I can't say it much better than John did. We saw the exact same thing. You give them a little bit of respect. You talk with them a little bit. And the next thing you know, they are giving you information that you would have had to spend a lot of time and resources trying to get.
Andrew?
Yeah, I think they pretty much summed it up. I don't think I have anything more to add to it than that.
Okay. Describe your feelings, Sean, when you left.
I think sometimes leaving is one of the most joyous experiences because you're coming back to your family. And at the same time, you kind of wonder to yourself, is what I'm doing going to last? Am I going to be able to come back here in 20 years with my wife and say, you know, this is a monument that we saw when we came by, you know? And I think leaving home or coming home is in some ways a little bittersweet.
Andrew?
Well, excuse me, when we were handing over our mission to the incoming unit, my platoon leader was the last one that had to go out. And the day before, I thought I had completed my last mission and breathed a huge sigh of relief. And he came to me that night and said, look, Doc, I'm going out one more time. I hate to ask this of you, but I would feel a whole lot better going with knowing that, you know, you're there with me. And he gave me the option to say no, but, you know, obviously I wasn't able to do that. And it just, my only thought was, give me back one more day, because at this point I'm in the hands of another unit. I'm with some new guys who have been in country 2 weeks, and I'm trusting them to get me through the day and get me back home. And that's all I was worried about, was getting, you know, making it through that last day after I thought I had already made it, you know, one more day earlier. But
well, we've only got a few minutes now. Boy, the hour, yeah, 3 minutes. There's a wonderful Nina. By the way, I want to say hello to Nina. Nina says hello to everybody. She's waving her hand. And do your thoughts take you back to that time that you were there? One of your thoughts today. You're in civilian life. Does that? I don't mean as PTSD. I mean that you think maybe you left something behind or you wish you would have done. John, go ahead.
To try to answer that question, my next door neighbors are Iraqis. The whole end of the block is, and as I hear news about what's going on there now, I constantly wonder how their families are. You know what I mean? And was there anything that I did, even indirectly, not knowing these people, almost 10 years ago now, is there anything that I could have done to make their experience better? You know what I mean? So I'm reminded of it every day.
Rachel, I know what you left back there. You left a piece of your flesh back there. But Do you find yourself thinking about those moments?
There is not a day that goes by that I don't think about either one of my deployments, actually. My troops are my family. They are closer to me than my blood. And I'm constantly thinking about where they are, how they're doing, my troops that are still going overseas. I'm worried about them pretty much every single day. And it's something that I think will always be with me.
Andrew.
I have 45 guys from my platoon that I've stayed in great contact with over the last 8 years. None of them still know my first name. They know me as Doc. So
keep a kit bag ready to go. Folks, you got to know this. This gentleman, Andrew, he has a kit bag. Tell us about that really quickly.
Well, it's just my medic bag. I never unpacked it. I just never got to the point where I felt like I wanted to empty it out. I looked through it about 4 months ago, and I still had expired IV solution from 2007 and bandages and gauzes and quick clot and anything I needed to, react on the spot.
Dale, do you have something to add?
No, I just want to add my admiration to both you, all three of you, for your service and what you've done. My question, if you have any, how much time we got? 1 minute. How do you feel about the changes that are occurring there? I mean, this is only 1 minute. I'm going to go to you first, John.
Very quick sound bite, John.
I think it's something that we probably expected that would happen, but something that we hoped wouldn't.
Andrew?
Yeah, exactly. I figured this was going to be happening, and here we are seeing it.
Rachel, John, Andrew, from Veterans Radio, Dale, myself, Nina, Derek, and all the folks here at Talk Radio 1600. God bless you, folks, and you are fine examples of our youth. Thank you very much for being on.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Dale, next week.
You're going to be talking about the arsenal of democracy.
And folks, we got 10 seconds. We're going to have the real Rosie the Riveter live right here on Veterans Radio. Don't miss it. You're dismissed.